Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for hanging out with us. And of course, we always like to have you guys check us out on a lot of cool locations. And one of them is where, Don?
TheValleyOutdoors.com.
A lot of interactive maps. Anything you're looking at doing to plan for your summer vacation and or any activity you're coming up, you're wondering what to do for the weekend. And then, of course, where else, Ava?
Facebook as well.
Check us out and like us, please. Always a big thing for us. So, story I picked up, I don't remember where I got it. Honestly, I can't remember. But it doesn't really matter where I got it from. The story comes out of Florida. And this gentleman describes what it's like to get dragged through a Florida swamp by a 200-pound python.
Well, I'm trying to picture how he's getting dragged.
Well, let's go into a little of the details,
okay,
shall we?
Share with me.
The gentleman's name is Carl Jackson. I'm gonna put the name out there because that's one hell of a task. And I'm not going to say what the result is because that would spoil a story, right?
Right.
202-pound python. It's the second heaviest ever in Florida. In this particular case, this is a Burmese python, and it was in the heart of the Florida Big Cypress National Preserve. This gentleman, Carl, is driving his truck to Bear Island Campground from one place to another, and he's with his wife and their 20-year-old son and daughter. And they had hunted snakes before, and the daughter had just gotten certified as an assistant with Carl's contracting company. And minimum age to be a python contractor assistant, okay? Contractor assistant is 14. This is the first day they had gone out together on official python hunt. 2:30 p.m., the Jacksons were happily rolling down the dirt road when they saw a python track going across the road. The track was about as wide as a mountain bike tire, just enough for the family to get their feet wet. Carl thought he got out of the vehicle, walked off the road, and immediately saw a giant snake head in the brush. I can only see about half its body, and I was thinking it was probably about 12 feet long. So he grabbed the head, and as soon as he grabbed it, he knew, oh no, I misjudged this one. He didn't even try to fight it. He just started dragging me towards the canal. Instead of letting go, he kept his hands just below the head and hung on for the ride. He said it dragged me through thick brush, then it dragged me over a red and black anthill, then it dragged me through more brush, and that's when I finally was able to get my feet hooked on some brush where I could get leverage. And the whole time he's yelling, I need some help.
Oh, my goodness. How old is this?
It doesn't say how old he is.
Okay.
I mean, he's not old. He's got a 14-year-old daughter and a 20-year-old son.
Okay.
So the python kept moving toward the nearest canal, and it might have taken him all the way into the water, but he dug his heels in and pulled on the snake, then stopped, put his energy into wrapping the attacker. He felt the snake coiling around the body and pushing him down into the dirt. That's when his son showed up. He was trying to get the coil around me and juking and driving and trying to keep it off me. Riker goes, uh-oh, now what do? I yelled out, grab the tail and stretch. Just keep the coils off. So they kept grabbing the tail, pulling as hard as he can. His daughter ran in to help. Carl, he had a 9mm handgun on his hip, was now regretting not shooting the snake when he had his chance. His family standing around, both hands occupied. There's no way to safely draw his weapon. He yelled at his daughter to grab the electrical tape that was in his left front pocket. She found it. Carl felt another coil around his back. The snake was now winning the tug of war with his son, who's 6'1 and 200 pounds. So his sister drops the tape, used all her strength to keep the snake from wrapping around her dad. Now I'm looking the snake dead in the mouth and is trying to eat my face. At the same time, my wife got there. She grabbed the tape while I'm fighting, wrapped the tape, taped the mouth shut, and the eyes as well, he said. Taped the eyes as well. For a moment, the tape python relaxed, allowing him to catch his breath, but it could still smell the nearby canal, and pretty soon it dragged him towards that again. The other three piled on the snake, got control of it, just a foot away from the bank of the canal. The snake had dragged him roughly 30 feet from where the wrestling match had begun. And at that point, the four Hunters carried the python back to the roadway where they grabbed a snake bag from the truck. The snake, way too big for the bag, grabbed his 22 caliber pistol and dispatched the snake. Crazy thing. He said the Burmese python took up most of the one-ton truck bed. And they went to weigh it, and it came out at 202 pounds. And that's the biggest snake they'd ever seen. 16 feet 10 inches long. Don, yeah,
you got to ask
say.
Why.
The heaviest snake on record in Florida was 215 pounds, and that was in 2022.
Yikes.
Now, the important thing here is, if you look at it, there's just another inserted story, but these people, you know, snake people that are capturing these, they've captured over 20 tons of invasive pythons. It is an invasive species,
right,
in Florida. And that's crazy. They followed to a taxidermist. While they're skinning it, they found 200 eggs inside, which is nearly double what the 215-pound, the bigger snake had. So,
more on the way.
He's more proud of the egg count and getting that out of the area
than
anything else. And
so what do they do with them? Do you have any idea?
They didn't say.
It'd really be interesting to know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's huge.
It's massive.
Yeah.
It's a
dinosaur.
The photo of this thing is
That's what it is.
I mean, if you put two hands on a table side by side,
and
it's wider than both your
wider
hands.
Wider than both hands.
Yep.
That's
on its back. So picture that.
No, thanks.
I don't know why I wouldn't have grabbed his head to begin with.
Well, I think to control a snake, you got to grab the head, right?
No, I'd have shot it.
Oh, I would have shot it first.
Yeah.
There's no question.
They're just kind of going backwards about this.
Yeah. Well, there is that.
Yeah.
Overconfidence. It's not a big snake. I'll just grab it. Ruh-roh.
Yeah. Well.
Famous last words. Good news coming out of the Minnesota DNR, Donald.
Yeah.
As the political football that we know and love, Mille Lacs Lake, the Minnesota DNR is now maintaining a 3 walleye bag limit for open water season in 2026. The anglers are now going to have an opportunity for those 3 walleyes between 17 and only 1 over 20 inches. So 17 to 20 inches and 1 over 20. So it doesn't have a minimum on that, which is nice.
Yeah.
Or a maximum, so you can have 1 over. Please keep 3 walleye limit for the open water season that was in place last summer through the ice fishing season. We've heard from anglers, and they want the opportunity to harvest on Mille Lacs while the population allows, especially early in the open water season. And they will offer that again. The state-licensed anglers share the harvest with, they call it a total take rate, safe harvest limit. That's combined with the Ojibwe band that retained fishing rights to conserve the fishery. That level is set in combination. The harvest level reflects a slight decline in the walleye population that was observed in last fall's assessment netting. Harvest is set at 105,000 pounds for the state, 79,000 pounds for tribal fishing, and the state's share of the harvest in 2025 was 113 pounds. But their people aren't going and getting those fish. And last week, Ava and I got on my soapbox last week, Don. You missed it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I missed it.
Yeah. No, it was a good thing. It was a good thing.
Okay.
You know, we had talked with the DNR about netting and what the observation levels really are versus what their test nets show. You and I were up to Gull Lake. Remember, we talked to Tom Landwehr about that, and they haven't changed net positions. I think that's a lot of what's happening as well, because the populations, from everything we've seen, heard, and discussed with people that spend a lot of time on that lake, the population's amazing. So, quite good. 2025, they had additional flexibility in managing the state-licensed anglers, uncertainty about how many anglers will fish the lake and how good it will be. It's difficult for them to precisely predict that poundage, so they probably, as they did last year, do a reevaluation prior to July. That's kind of the concept there. As long as they don't exceed the share annual harvest by 15%, they should be fine. And again, they'll adjust regulations during the season to prevent that from exceeding 105,000 pounds at that
point. I mean, that's going to be a pretty healthy spread because everything 17 and under are going to be reproduction fish.
Well, you know, and we talked about it last week. You know, if you look at a population of any fish, it's going to be large fish are in a pyramid. They're at the very top. That means the minimum amount. The smaller fish have a greater population at the bottom of what you imaginary shape of a pyramid would be.
Yep.
And at one point, if you remember correctly, Mille Lacs had a, was it 14 to 16 or 15 to 17 inch slot limit. There wasn't one fish that would make it through that slot. So at that point, you suddenly now don't have a pyramid anymore. It's tipped over. You have no feeders for the bigger fish. So having a much larger window is a major piece of the puzzle in my mind. And I think it's nothing but going to help the fishery as a whole until we can come up with a better way to actually measure what's really going on with the fish. So
sure.
But nonetheless, it's good news.
It's always good news.
I don't mind it. I don't mind that. Shed hunting, Don, big thing. A lot of people like shed hunting.
I think it's got a lot to do with walking in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a healthy thing to do. Like you say, it's not that common that you find them because a lot of those sheds left the field in the fall on the deer. So what you're looking for are those that were fortunate enough to make it through the season.
Yep.
And to carry on, so.
And I think the other thing, too, is there are also animals that will eat and take care of that healthy resource, mineral piece.
So right.
They'll chew on that as well. But so I've got five tips to help you put more shed deer antlers in your bag. And remember we were talking about this out west, and they would open up shed hunting to an area. It was closed, closed, closed. They'd open it up, and they'd have people, like, lined up running to try and
find sheds. Yeah, like an Easter egg hunt.
This crazy, crazy, crazy. Okay, so five tips point you in the right direction. Number one, start your search where there are bucks. That would make sense, right?
Yes, where there
probably
were bucks in the fall.
Probably a good basis for a start.
Yep.
Public hunting grounds that look like car dealerships during the deer season with that kind of hunting pressure. How many bucks survive the shed antlers in the area? Not many. Well, the majority where sheds are in public ground realize that searching where few deer survive can be futile. As you just said,
yep.
Find areas you're better off. There are good deer numbers, and particularly good buck numbers. Private property is a good bet if you have access, especially if hunters pass up young bucks, letting them survive the shed antler scenario, as we were talking about. You obviously want to look on your own hunting land if you have it. It's harder to knock on a farmer's door and get permission to go on his land, but it's still possible, especially if you're only there to shed hunt.
Right.
So that's always a good thing. Lightly hunted public land can also be productive if you're wanting to put some miles on. Even city park land where deer can't be hunted, that can be good. I mean, around here, you could do that. In Red Wing, you know, there's some good spots. You'd be surprised how many deer live in urban settings. Just ask the woman who wants to move the deer crossing sign when the...
Right. You know, that's a good point because in urban areas, there's not a lot of hunting.
No.
So those bucks survive and they do drop them.
Yep.
I mean, I wouldn't mind finding the buck I saw in my backyard last fall.
Well, get after it.
Well, I haven't seen him since, so he moved on.
In one way or another.
And well, it's, I mean, there's a lot of area in our community, but.
Oh, yeah. So next piece of this, find a food source. It's easier to do, obviously, in farm country. Pay attention to which fields deer prefer. You know they're going to go into certain fields and feed. Find those trails. Find those key pieces of property that will attract many, many deer. Deer don't usually travel far from the feeding and bedding areas, which is a key piece. On a micro level, deer may come to a single tree, whether it's a crabapple tree still dropping fruit or a cedar tree. But it all will be considered as a food source.
Sure.
find a bedding area. Although the snow is gone, you can't miss, you don't want to miss the antlers getting out there. Well, if there's still snow in your area, which right now doesn't look like it, but who knows what happens.
Right.
They spend a lot of time bedded during cold weather, and those are definitely productive spots. I've heard much about that in the past, finding sheds that are not far from the bedded areas. It could be brush thicket along a farm field, CRP grass, or just a hillside, which we'll talk about that in a second. Canopy blocks, that's the other thing. Coniferous forests, pine trees, that kind of thing, where they'll hang out. Swampland areas, if there's anything nearby, same thing. Stay on the south side. South-facing hillsides are ideal bedding spots, and south orientation is key to any bedding area, and you'll find, obviously, much more deer because it's warmth and it's visibility as well. So they're able to see what's going on there. And last but not least, don't get discouraged. And that's one of the big words of advice coming from the article. if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, even the best shed hunters get skunked. Set yourself up for success. Go where there's bucks. Keep your eyes on the ground. Don't get distracted from the task of finding sheds. Put the time in. Check every suspicious branch or corn stalk. Don't be afraid of that. It might be a year or two before you find a shed, but once you do, it's a thrill. And after you get the first under your belt, something clicks, you're good to go. Get a dog.
I was just going to add.
Get a shed-heading dog.
More and more dogs are getting trained to shed hunt.
To shed hunt, I know.
Yeah, I was going to do that with mine, but she got too old.
Well, sometimes it makes a difference just to go out and have fun nonetheless.
Yes, it's a great way to get out in nature.
Well, speaking of, hard to believe we're getting out in nature already. How close are we? I mean, we're wrapping up the show already, aren't we? Dang. Time flies when you're having fun, Don.
It does. Next week.
I know.
We'll do it again.
I know. Looks like it's going to be a great weekend, everybody. I hope everybody has fun. Be safe. And lots of things going on right now.
Yep. Sports shows.
Fishing's going. It's going to be a great day to get out fishing on the river, whatever river you're nearby. Get out there, have fun, and enjoy the outdoors for what it is. And you're going to make it life but much better. For Ava, Don, and myself, we are the Valley Outdoors. Have fun out there, and hope to see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Outdoors Radio, brought to you by Vexus Boats, building dreams with an unequaled passion for excellence. Catch us next week, same time, same place. Have a great day on the water or in the field.